This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts on these topics. The content provided by the podcast is not intended and should not construe as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We attempt to avoid use of opinion, but all opinions represented are our own and are not representative of employer. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy our podcast.
Welcome back to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
So welcome back. This is our third episode of the year, and our first two are now live. Casey, how are you feeling about the first couple episodes?
I'm really excited, Alex. You know, as the interns are settling in, our lives get a little bit easier. You know who else is settling in? The Chiefs.
That's right. And we've got Brian here to discuss our first case. So let's just go ahead and get started.
So I know I've seen cefepime used a lot more in the hospital these days, and with that, a lot more cefepime-induced neurotoxicity.
Yeah. So when I was an intern, we actually didn't use that much cefepime. We preferred Zosyn, but then our antibiogram changed and we began using a lot more cefepime. The other thing that we learned is that the combination of vancomycin and Zosyn actually has a much higher incidence of AKI or acute renal injury than does cefepime and vancomycin. So that's why we use cefepime a lot more in the hospital now. So it was actually approved in 1994, but it wasn't until 1998 that people first started to see neurotoxicity. One of the main risk factors for cefepime-induced neurotoxicity is renal dysfunction. About 80% of patients that end up having cefepime-induced neurotoxicity have renal dysfunction.
And that would make sense, right? Because cefepime is renally cleared.
Yes. Actually, too, about 50% of those patients have cefepime inappropriately dosed based on their renal function. So a lot of the fault is on us. So really, when dosing cefepime, you should watch the renal function and talk with your pharmacist about appropriate dosing.
So we always discuss cefepime neurotoxicity and the risk it carries when we start the medicine. But what does it actually look like when you see it in practice? And what should we be looking out for?
Yeah, so I've actually seen it personally in one patient. So they're altered. The other thing that you commonly see is myoclonus. And one of the things you see particular with cefepime is myoclonus of the paraorbital muscles. The other thing that people commonly get is an EEG, and about 75% of those patients will have abnormalities on their EEG, and about half have the classic triphasic waves that are discussed in textbooks.
Wow. So you're actually talking about an EEG that shows something other than generalized slowing.
Surprising, isn't it?
So when you see someone with these symptoms, what are you thinking as far as treatment goes?
Yeah. So the most important thing is to stop the cefepime. The other thing is you need to call your nephrologist and ask them if dialysis is in order, because they can dialyze the patient and get off the excess cefepime. Interestingly, benzodiazepines have been proposed as a theoretical treatment, and this has to do with the molecular pathogenesis of cefepime-induced neurotoxicity. So most often these patients are septic, and in sepsis, the blood-brain barrier gets leaky because the tight junctions begin to separate, and this leads to more cefepime in the CSF. So with increased cefepime levels in the CSF, this results in cefepime acting as a GABA-A antagonist on postsynaptic neurons. In contrast, benzodiazepines are a GABA-A agonist. And so theoretically, this could be used as a treatment for cefepime-induced neurotoxicity. However, you're really hard-pressed to give someone who is confused and altered benzodiazepines. So I think, again, some of the high-yield takeaways from Elise's talk are the fact that cefepime needs to be renally dosed, and you need to pay very close attention to that dosing in patients with renal dysfunction. Some of the things you should be looking for in addition to altered mental status are myoclonus and EEG changes, and that for treatment, you need to have a very low threshold to call your friendly nephrologist for hemodialysis.
So we're taught very early in our medical careers that it's important that anytime a patient with cirrhosis is admitted to the hospital, that we do a diagnostic paracentesis if they have any ascites. But I heard that Matt gave us a great talk into exactly why we do that.
Yeah, that's right. Matt Myers gave a really great talk on SBP, and I really liked it because, as you're right, it's something we learn about very early on in medical school, and then we all think we have a great handle on, but I really learned a lot from Matt's talk. So SBP, just to get us all on the same page, is a bacterial infection of ascites in the absence of a focal contiguous source, occurring almost exclusively in decompensated cirrhotic patients. Some papers have estimated that the prevalence of SBP in hospitalized cirrhotic patients is as high as 30%, and in fact, up to 13% of these patients are asymptomatic and have benign abdominal exams. It's also thought that delayed treatment of SBP that leads to septic shock can have an in-hospital mortality rate as high as 30%.
So I guess then that's why it's so important that we tap every single patient, even if they don't have symptoms?
Yes. Actually, Matt quoted from a recent Curbsider episode where Dr. Scott Matherly was interviewed, and he actually said, quote, "Any cirrhotic admitted with any complaint with ascites has SBP until proven otherwise."
So Brian, why do we tend to see SBP in only patients with cirrhosis?
Yeah, I think that that's very interesting. You know, so as an oncologist, I see a lot of patients with peritoneal carcinomatosis, and they also have ascites, but rarely do we see them developing SBP. And so Matt touched on the reasons for why this might be. So number one, cirrhotic patients tend to have bacterial overgrowth in their intestines. And number two, their bowel wall is more permeable, allowing for easier translocation of this bacteria. And then number three, just in general, cirrhotics kind of have global immune dysfunction. Specifically, Matt highlighted poor opsonization or targeting of bacteria by phagocytic cells due to factors like decreased chemotaxis and decreased phagocytic activity. Ultimately, Matt's point was that you should have a very high clinical suspicion for SBP in cirrhotic patients with ascites.
So after we do the diagnostic paracentesis, what are we looking for as far as diagnosis?
Yeah, I tell my medical students that there's very few numbers you have to know as a medical student, but this is one. If you do a diagnostic paracentesis and there are 250 neutrophils or higher, that is very clinically indicative of SBP in those patients to be treated. The gold standard, of course, is to grow an organism. And Matt actually taught me something that I didn't know, that you can increase the yield of a paracentesis by 80% by inoculating your cultures at the bedside rather than allowing the lab to do that for you later on. So then, of course, if you diagnose someone with SBP, you have to treat them. Commonly here at Vanderbilt, we use ceftriaxone, but ceftriaxone is also a good alternative, as are quinolones and Augmentin.
And then, of course, after you treat SBP, the management doesn't end quite there, does it, Brian?
Yes, that's right. So if a patient has an episode of SBP, they have a 70% risk of having another bout of SBP in the next year. And so for these patients, we often do prophylaxis. And so prophylaxis can be Bactrim, one double strength tablet daily, or ciprofloxacin, 500 milligrams daily.
So Brian, when we counsel patients in clinic, we always say that alcohol is bad for the liver. But I heard that our very own Alex Wiles gave a great presentation about how exactly alcohol damages the liver.
Yeah, Alex actually gave a great talk about alcoholic-induced hepatitis. And so pretty much anyone who takes alcohol in excess, they develop steatosis. Steatosis is readily reversible, but if it persists, it can cause an inflammatory milieu that then results in hepatitis. So this kind of occurs in three ways. So first of all, the adipocytes that cause steatohepatitis are metabolically active, and this results in an increase in inflammatory cytokines that are being released in the liver environment. Second, alcohol is directly toxic to hepatocytes when it's metabolized to acetaldehyde, and then also this results in increased reactive oxygen species, further increasing the inflammatory milieu in the liver. And finally, third, prolonged exposure to alcohol actually increases our gut permeability, and this results in increased translocation of gut bacteria. And so these gut bacteria increase expression of LPS within the liver. This activates comfort cells, which then further increases the inflammatory milieu in the liver. And so ultimately, these three things create an inflammatory cycle that lead to fibrosis, which of course then leads to cirrhosis.
So really, what's the classic presentation of alcoholic hepatitis, or what sorts of things should we be looking for?
So yeah, the classic patient with alcoholic-induced hepatitis usually presents with rapid onset jaundice. You can palpate their liver on exam, and they will express that they have right upper quadrant pain. Sometimes they have fevers, and that doesn't necessarily correlate with an infection, although these patients often do have an infection that can lead to death. Most of the time, the patients will endorse that they've had a very high drinking history. So this usually correlates with 7 beers a day for about 20 years or 100 grams of alcohol a day. Some of them, though, will tell you that they've stopped drinking. So some of the lab abnormalities you see are a T-bili greater than 3, an AST-ALT greater than 1.5 times the upper limit of normal. And then usually you see kind of a 2-to-1 ratio AST to ALT. Other common lab abnormalities you'll see are anemia. But ultimately, the gold standard diagnosis is a liver biopsy.
This really sounds like an inflammatory process. Is this something that we use steroids for?
That's right. So current guidelines actually recommend that steroids be used. And this stems from a paper that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2015, which showed that giving these patients prednisone reduced the risk of mortality in the first 28 days by 38%. However, it does not have any impact on 6-month or 12-month mortality. And one of the things that Alex highlighted is that use of steroids actually increases your risk of developing an infection from 7% to 13%. So actually, some of the hepatologists here at Vanderbilt do not use steroids because of this reason.
Sounds like it's pretty controversial then.
I think it is.
In Matt's presentation about SBP, we talked a little bit about prophylaxis, but here we want to dig in a little bit deeper into some of the newest literature about it.
Yeah, and so Brian, you highlighted secondary prophylaxis, which is prophylaxis after someone has actually had SBP, and that just makes sense. If someone's had SBP once, they're going to have it again. But a lot of the data going on in hepatology is actually showing that primary prophylaxis is also of benefit. So there was a large trial in 2007 in the Journal of Gastroenterology that used norfloxacin, which is a fluoroquinolone antibiotic, in patients with cirrhosis who had very specific criteria. And those were with a low protein ascites, so less than 1.5 total protein in their ascites fluid, and had signs of advanced liver failure. So there were two groups. You could either have child pew score greater than 9, which is class C, with a bili greater than 3, or you could have impaired renal function, which can be measured by a creatinine of greater than 1.2, BUN greater than 25, or a serum sodium less than 130. So if you're in either one of those two groups, you were included in this trial. And they took 35 patients and gave them a year's worth of norfloxacin. And they took another 33 patients and they gave them a placebo pill.
They really looked at the 3-month and 1-year probability of survival. They also looked at the 1-year probability of development of SBP and hepatorenal syndrome.
And the results they got were pretty impressive. So the patients that took norfloxacin daily had a 1-year probability of developing SBP of 7% versus 61%. That's huge. The p-value was less than 0.001. They also had reduced hepatorenal syndrome and an improved 3-month and 1-year probability of survival compared with the placebo group.
So overall in this study, they showed that daily antibiotics in people with high-risk ascites had a great impact on decreasing the incidence of SBP and also delaying the development of hepatorenal syndrome. Most importantly, it also improved survival.
And so I think what we take away from this is paying attention to the protein level in our ascites fluid. I think that we all know to calculate the SAG. We all know that if there's 250 neutrophils that we need to treat for SBP, and those people need to be on secondary prophylaxis. But this should raise your suspicion to draw a protein level in the ascites. And if it's less than 1.5, look up these criteria for people that should be on lifelong primary prophylaxis, because we can reduce their risk of SBP and also improve their mortality.
Thanks, Brian. Stay tuned for our next episode with Cases Across the Street with Peter.